My name is Andrew Hailstrap. I'm an Emeritus Professor of Biochemistry at the University of Bristol, and I'm also National Chair of the organization that's co-sponsoring this event, which is Christians in Science. And the university is also kindly sponsoring this event, and we are very grateful for the Public and Ceremonial Events Office and all the staff who've helped to make this possible. It's a wonderful venue, and we are very grateful and privileged to be here. I'd also like to thank our local Christians in Science committee, Christina Biggs, Zoe Holland, and Carl Detman, for all the effort that they put in to make this evening possible. For those of you who don't know about Christians in Science, it's an organization that seeks to support Christians in the sciences and to promote an intellectually rigorous understanding of the relationship between mainstream science and the Christian faith that engenders mutual respect. We have local events, and you will have found a flyer on your seats, and the rolling screen has shown you what's on for the next term, so do take a look at that. I do, of course, need to have a few housekeeping announcements. In the case of fire, you have fire exits there, there, and at the back. Go to your nearest clear fire exit, should there be a fire, and the stewards will direct you. I should also ask you at this stage, if you haven't already done so, please to switch off or put on silent your mobile phones. Now, we don't make a charge for tonight's event. It's a free event. But if you would like to make a donation to the work of Christians in Science and to offset some of the expenditure of tonight, there are buckets on the way out when you go out, and we'd be very grateful for any donation you feel you'd like to give. There are also leaflets there about the work of Christians in Science, which you might be interested in seeing. So now it gives you great pleasure to introduce Alistair McGrath to you. From the speed with which tickets went for tonight, it's clear he doesn't need much introduction. His fame goes before him. The seats were all booked within 24 hours, which is quite staggering. So that says something. Alistair was an undergraduate at Oxford University, where he studied chemistry. He went up as an atheist, but was soon convinced by the claims of the Christian faith. After graduation, he stayed on at Oxford for doctoral studies in molecular biophysics with Sir George Radder, and then he moved on to study Christian theology. He subsequently developed a specialist interest in the relationship between science and faith, and as many of you know, he's a prolific author on the topic, both of academic works and also those of more general appeal. Alistair has held several prestigious academic positions, both in Oxford University and King's College London, and is currently Andreas Idrios Professor of Science and Religion at Oxford University. As a former atheist, Alistair is particularly interested in the way in which science has been used in recent atheist apologetics. He has published studies on Richard Dawkins and an award-winning biography of C.S. Lewis, whose writings had a great influence on him. I'd recommend that book. I read it over the summer. It's excellent. His most recent book is the one on the screen here, Inventing the Universe, Why We Can't Stop Talking About Science, Faith, and God. And it's only just published, and Hodder and Stoughton is the publisher, and do get a copy. Tonight's lecturee links in the topic of that book and his previous book very nicely. And I'm going to invite Alistair up to give his lecture, Science, Faith, and God, Richard Dawkins versus C.S. Lewis on the Meaning of Life. Alistair.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, let me begin by saying it's really wonderful to be here tonight. I'd like to thank the people who've organized this, but of course all of you for coming as well. And what I thought I'd do is talk about science, faith, and God. It's the topic of my recent book. It's a question that really mattered to me. I used to be an atheist, and then while I was an undergraduate at Oxford, I kind of way transitioned to Christianity and sort of way had to work out how on earth did I relate faith to science. And over a period of 40 years, I figured out some ways of doing it. I'm going to talk about some of those tonight. But I thought, actually, that might be rather dull. And so to make it much more interesting, I thought, let's have some dialogue partners. And Richard Dawkins is an excellent figure to engage with. He's very important, very influential, has lots of interesting ideas. And, of course, C.S. Lewis, also very well known. And I thought that they might, in effect, give us some dialogue partners to help us make this conversation more interesting and also, of course, to make sure that we have an atheist voice in this conversation. I just want to make it clear that although I am a former atheist, I'm sort of an atheist who lapsed at the age of 18 or so, I'm enormously respectful of atheism. For those of you here tonight who are atheists, just don't worry. These questions we're talking about are really interesting. They're very important as well. And what I'm going to be doing is saying, you know, not this is right, trust me. It's much more, look, let's look at these questions. I'm going to tell you what I think, but really the important thing is actually what you think. And so I hope that this lecture will really be helpful in opening up some of the questions and maybe giving you an idea of some of the issues and some of the answers. So these really are big questions. Now, we obviously have a limited amount of time, and I'm going to try and look at four questions. One of them, of course, is the place of evidence and reason in belief. In other words, what is it that makes us say, I think this is right, I think this can be trusted? Why do we believe certain things and not other things? And of course, the backdrop to this is this transition between modern and postmodern thinking, which I think most of you here tonight will be on the postmodern side of this. Some of you, of course, will be on the more modern side. But I want to try and explain why this actually feeds into our conversation tonight. There's a backdrop to all of this, and it's a changed understanding of, if you like, the limits of human knowledge, the way in which we reason. And of course, that's very important to us as we reflect about what science can and cannot do. Which, of course, feeds in very naturally to this question. One of the issues I'm going to be looking at is whether science is able to tell us everything we know, or is it like an island of knowledge, which is very important and very interesting, but actually has its limits. In other words, there are certain questions, perhaps very big questions, which may lie beyond the scope of science to answer. And if that's so, well, how do we answer these? And finally, of course, I want to look at how this question of meaning begins to emerge. Meaning's not an empirical notion. It's not like looking at the ocean and saying it's blue on a good day. It's something which we interpret. It's something that we tease out. It's something that we perhaps discern, but it's not something that stares us in the face. And so we're going to be looking at, first of all, why meaning matters, and then how we might go about figuring what this meaning might be. So our conversation partners tonight are, of course, very well known. Richard Dawkins, who until his retirement was Professor of the Public Understanding of Science at Oxford. And he wrote a number of books. The first of his books that I read was The Selfish Gene. Came out in 76. I actually read it a year later. It's a very engaging, very interesting book. But of course, also for our purposes tonight, his more recent book, The God Delusion, opens up some of these big questions like, is faith irrational? Is it running away from reality? And I want to make sure that we engage those. And of course, Dawkins is an atheist, but perhaps we just need to say that that word atheism can be understood in different ways. It might refer to somebody who simply, as a matter of fact, doesn't believe in God, but A, doesn't find that interesting, and B, doesn't find it important. In other words, it in effect is just saying, I don't really want to get involved in that. Richard Dawkins is a committed atheist, someone who says, look, I believe that there is no God. This is actually part of who I am. This gives meaning and direction to my life. And in many ways, I'll be talking more about that committed form of atheism tonight, which, of course, is why Richard Dawkins is such an obvious dialogue partner. On the other side, of course, we have C.S. Lewis. Dawkins, of course, an evolutionary biologist who moved from Anglicans to atheism. Lewis, someone who began studying classics and English at Oxford, and then, of course, moved to, in effect, moved from atheism to what he called mere Christianity. Now, what he means by that, I think many of you will know, is a kind of generic Christianity, not Anglicanism, not being a Catholic, but in effect, just being an ordinary Christian. And I'll be using some of his ideas tonight, because I think you'll find them very, very interesting. So, let's begin. Is faith reasonable? What sort of questions might we want to ask to begin to answer that question? And of course, both Dawkins and Lewis emphasize that we do need reasons for our beliefs. And we need to think about questions like, you know, why do we accept some beliefs and not others? Dawkins, I think, is very hostile to the idea of faith of any kind. I would say myself that there are certain things we can say are right, and that's the end of the matter. But I'm also aware there are some things where I would say, well, I think that, or I believe that. Of course, one of these would be the God question, but also in science you'll find there are many issues. For example, the debate about whether there is a single universe or a multiverse, where in effect you have to make a decision on the basis of incomplete evidence that this is the better of these judgments. But Dawkins, I think, feels that faith is unwise, unnecessary, and certainly he takes the view that science really doesn't have any place for it. He writes, faith means blind trust in the absence of evidence, even in the teeth of evidence. This is from his book, The Selfish Gene, and in the second edition he added this comment, that faith is a kind of mental illness. I think that may be overstatement. I think it's also rather unwise. But I think there is an issue here about whether faith is wrong full stop, or whether it is simply a fact of life, that actually in most situations we have to have some kind of faith because we need to reach some kind of decision, and the evidence isn't good enough to force us to a decision. There's Dawkins in The Selfish Gene. It's a classic statement of a sort of scientific positivism, which is saying you believe what can be proved. Let me read it to you. Faith is a state of mind that leads people to believe something, it doesn't matter what, in the total absence of supporting evidence. If there were good supporting evidence, then faith would be superfluous because the evidence would compel us to believe it anyway. I want to say, I think there are some situations where actually, you know, you are compelled to believe certain things because the evidence is so good. But the real difficulty is that certainly in science and also in most areas of life, you find yourself unable to reach a firm decision because you know the evidence either is inadequate or the evidence is open to multiple interpretations. And certainly Dawkins' approach is very important and underlies the new atheism, that movement that really began in 2006 with the God delusion and continued with Christopher Hitchens' book, God is Not Great, in 2007. It's beginning to fade away now, but certainly it raised some very good questions, and we're going to be making sure we engage some of those tonight. It's very much a sort of what you see is what you get approach, and in effect it limits reality to what reason and science can prove. In other words, it's a very strong doctrine. You only believe what you can prove, and therefore naturally you're going to ask the question, well, you know, what is there that you can prove in this way? And so I want to begin to explore with you whether this is actually right. I want to look at this central piece of this quote from Dawkins. If there were good supporting evidence, then faith would be superfluous, for the evidence would compel us to believe it anyway. I want to just reflect on whether that actually is right. The first point I want to make, and I'll be leading into this in a moment, is it does seem to me to be very modern to reflect that way of thinking that became so influential in Western Europe from about 1700 onwards. But I think nowadays we're just a little bit more cautious about this. The real difficulty is I think we do need to make a very important distinction between, listen to these phrases very carefully, the total absence of supporting evidence and the absence of totally supporting evidence. These are not the same. And the real difficulty, as those of you who are scientists will know, is that very often you are confronted with a body of evidence, and the evidence does not unequivocally point simply to one conclusion. It could mean this, it could mean that, and you have to try and do a sort of algorithm of assessment to work out what is right and what's not. So it is, I think, a very difficult thing to engage with. I want to commend Dawkins for saying, look, you've got to have reasons for believing things. You can't just make things up. There's got to be some sort of rational basis. There's got to be some sort of evidential link to the real world. But actually, it's a lot more complex than he allows. And of course, there are many who would say that really, when all is said and done, proof is something that's really limited to mathematics and logic. And you can think without difficulty of any of lots of things there where you can prove something logically. But in science, it is much more complex. And I gave you the example a moment ago of this very important debate that's going on in cosmology. Is there a single universe, or is there a multiverse, a kind of bubble of universes, which may seem quite counterintuitive, but is one way of looking at the idea of cosmic inflation. Here's the issue. The evidence is not conclusive. And in effect, there are lots of people who I know who are good scientists who will say, we think this. The others will say, no, no, we think that. But the key point I want to make is they do not disrespect each other. They just say, this is the nature of science. Very often, we have evidence that is not absolutely clear, and we have to make a judgment as to which of these options is right. I believe in the universe, I believe in the multiverse, means in effect I think the evidence is supportive of what I think, but at the moment I cannot prove that I am right. I want to suggest to you that actually that really is just a very characteristic view in the natural sciences. And it goes beyond science. There's Terry Eagleton, who's a well-known cultural critic, who's simply making the point that in real life, actually, we find ourselves forced into this position a lot of times. We hold many beliefs that have no unimpeachably rational justification, but are nonetheless reasonable to entertain. In plain English, look, there's a lot of stuff we believe, and we think we're right to believe it, but we know we cannot prove this to be right. And that, I think, is important. Certainly in the case of C.S. Lewis, we find a very clear recognition of this point. Lewis, interestingly, describes himself as an empirical theist who came to faith through induction. And Lewis was initially an atheist who moved over to Christianity. And there were a number of issues, I think, that inclined him towards atheism as a young man. One of them, of course, was his belief that science simply eroded any place for God. Another was his acute alertness to the problem of suffering, which was enhanced by his experience of the Great War. Lewis served in the British Army during the First World War and was wounded and had to be invalided out of the army. But we find Lewis having growing doubts about especially the existential adequacy of atheism, by which I mean something like this. In his 20s, Lewis thought, look, there's no God, that's pretty settled, but it's not actually very interesting. It doesn't satisfy the deep questions I'm asking, the real needs I have. It wasn't really something that Lewis felt he could base his life on. And Lewis describes his dilemma something like this. There's a quote from his autobiography, Surprised by Joy. And what I want you to notice is Lewis, in effect, saying, look, there's something deep within me that suggests there has to be more than what reason discloses. On the one side, a many-islanded sea of poetry and myth. On the other, a glib and shallow rationalism. Nearly all that I loved, I believe to be imaginary. Nearly all that I believe to be real, I thought grim and meaningless. And what Lewis is describing is this feeling, look, here's what I think I can show to be right. But actually, it doesn't do the job. It's not really getting to me. It's not really answering the questions that are at the heart of my life. And that, I think, is important, because Lewis is beginning to say, look, there are perhaps, if I can put it like this, cognitive criteria. Does this make sense? But existential criteria, does this do something for my life? And one of the things I think I see in Lewis's writings is this. You can prove shallow truths, things that actually, when all is said and done, don't matter all that much. but the really big truths that give our lives direction and orientation and meaning actually lie beyond proof. And I'll come back to that, because it is very important. What brought Lewis to faith, actually, I mean, this is something that makes a lot of sense to me, because in many ways my own transition from atheism to Christianity was basically that Christianity gave me a better way of seeing things. And Lewis describes Christianity as a way of looking at the world that seems to make so much more sense than its alternative, especially his younger atheism. And you may know this quote from Lewis, which I think summarizes this point very, very well. I believe in Christianity as I believe the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. And the point that Lewis is making is that, if I put it like this, it's like being on a mountaintop, a sun rises, the shadows begin to disappear, the mist begins to burn off. You begin to see more clearly, you begin to see further than would otherwise be the case. And one of the reasons that Lewis gave for coming to faith was basically it gave him this deeper and richer vision of seeing the world, understanding his own experience, his observations, and of course also this very important point of bringing things into focus. And we'll come back to that later. So where are we on this one? Well, I'm going to make a few suggestions and see if you think I'm right. There's a quote from John Polkinghorne, a physicist who late in life became a theologian. Here he's reflecting on the role of evidence in science and faith. And he says, look, neither science nor religion can entertain the hope of establishing logically coercive proof of the kind that only a fool would deny. No one can avoid some degree of intellectual precariousness, and as a consequent need for a degree of cautious daring in the quest for truth. What's he saying? What he's saying is, look, maybe the number of things we can prove to be true is actually quite limited, and maybe the things that really matter in life might lie just on the far side of proof. In other words, we can give good reasons for thinking they are right, but realize that we cannot actually give the absolutely compelling proof for these things that some would say that we need. Now, let me just pause here and add one more voice to this conversation. It's Sir Isaiah Berlin, the Oxford scholar who I think many of you will know, who specialized in the study of intellectual history in the 20th century. And Berlin made the point. He said, look, when I look at the kind of things people believe, they fall into three categories. Category number one, things you can prove by logic. Category number two, things you can prove by science. Category number three, things you can't prove in either of those ways. Now, thus far, well, that's incontestable. But here's the interesting point. Berlin said, anything to do with morality, to do with religion, to do with politics, to do with anti-religion, is in that third and final category. They are beliefs we can't actually prove to be right. And Berlin made two points, and I think both of these are right, but I'm going to leave it to you to think about this. Number one, that means that we can have this degree of intellectual precariousness, realizing that this is just part of the human situation. You know, we long for proof, but actually in most cases we won't get it. And number two, Berlin said, since we're all in the same boat, perhaps we need to be generous towards each other rather than being hypercritical. And that, I think, is an interesting point. But it leads me into the second broad area I want to look at, which is philosophical shifts. And I'm going to explain this very, very simply. Once you get the point, you'll see exactly where we're going. Modernity, that great movement in the past, which basically began in the 17th century with Descartes' Discourse on Method and Spinoza's Ethic, which basically said, look, we can know things for certain. There are certain necessary truths or luminously self-evident propositions that we can have and hold. In other words, there is this incorrigible knowledge that we can have, which is absolutely secure. And this is a view that you will still find today. But I have to say, it is beginning to crumble under the weight of evidence and the critical direction that is given to it. Postmodernity, which really begins in the 20th century with Heidegger's Being and Time, or Wittgenstein's Philosophical Investigations, or Gadamer's Truth and Method, basically argues like this. With great reluctance, we have to say goodbye to the modern way of thinking, because it just doesn't work. It's just unrealistic. We have to realize that things are a bit more complex than that. In other words, we have to begin to realize that we have to end up believing things we can't prove to be true, but nevertheless to believe to be trustworthy. This idea of fiduciary judgments, things we believe to be right, we trust, but know we can't be proved. And postmodern writers just say, look, this isn't really a problem. It's just the way we are as human beings, and we've got to learn to live with this tension. And in many ways, what I'm saying to you tonight is, although I have great respect for the modern position and wish it were right, you know, if we could prove everything, then that would sort a lot of stuff out. But the reality is, it's a lot more complex than that. And that's why I think we need to think very, very hard about the limits of knowledge in this situation. And again, if we look at Berlin's approach, basically he's simply saying, we've got to face up to our limits as human beings, stop being unrealistic, and try to work within these limits. Now, I personally think that this is right. And it does feed into a whole range of discussions that we're going to have. And it leads naturally into the third broad area, the scope and the limits of science. Now, I want to make it clear to you that you know, I did chemistry at Oxford. I then did research in molecular biophysics, trying to figure out how cells work, doing lots of interesting experiments. And it was very, very exciting. And I love science. I loved it then. I love it now. But, you know, love is not uncritical. You've got to ask those hard questions. And what I'm going to do is tease out some of those questions as we go along. One of the biggest ones really is this, you know, does science, in effect, gobble up the conceptual space that God was once thought to be occupied? Do scientific explanations always win out? For Dawkins, the progress of science always entails the retreat of faith. And again, for Dawkins, science proves its assertions, whereas religion just asserts them. So I think there's a lot of interesting ideas there. I want to begin to look at these and see where they take us. I think the first place to begin is just by looking at Lewis. Lewis basically would say something like this. Science is provisional. It's on a journey, and it hasn't reached the end of that journey. Now, I personally think this might be right. And if you're a historian, you'll see immediately the point that Lewis is getting at. Lewis is saying, if you look back in history, you will see that science believed many things in the past which it no longer believes. And that's just the way science is. Science is so great precisely because it is so open-minded. It's always reviewing the evidence. And when new evidence comes along that says to you, this way of thinking actually doesn't work anymore, you change your mind. But the difficulty is this. It means you cannot freeze science, so to speak, and say, this is what science is. Science is really a method rather than a body of knowledge. And the application of that method means that the body of knowledge is going to change as time goes on. And the example I'll be giving in this lecture, just to make this point, is, look, the massive changes we're seeing in our understanding of the origins of the universe. Because if we were meeting here 100 years ago, and we were to ask, what is the scientific consensus on the origins of the universe, I think the general response would be, well, look, you know, this is a stupid question. The universe has always been there. That's what the science of the day tended to think. Whereas nowadays, of course, we think in terms of the universe having origins and wondering what the philosophical, religious, metaphysical implications of that would be. The second point that Lewis makes is this. Look, science works by induction. And inevitably, that is not going to deliver the certainty that many of us seem to want. It means that, in effect, if you let science answer your questions rather than answering them in the way you want it to answer, you'll find it's more tentative than you might think. And Lewis just says that's the way it is. Lewis would disagree with Dawkins. I mean, Dawkins, as you heard, is in effect saying, look, there is no place for God in science. He's kind of way being squeezed out by science. Lewis actually says it's not like that. Lewis argues that Christianity is able to provide an intellectual framework that makes so much sense of the scientific enterprise and its successes. Now, there are a lot of ideas bubbling up from those brief comparisons I've made, and I'm going to explore them in more detail because I think there's lots to have to look at. There's a quote I'd like to give you from a writer of the early 20th century who basically was a theologian trying to put into words his irritation at those who said, look, God is just an extra item of furniture in the world. And he was saying, no, it's not like that. It's much more, God is the basis of everything. And he writes this, rationalism tries to find a place for God in its picture of the world. But God cannot be fitted into a diagram. He's rather the canvas on which the picture is painted or the frame in which it's set. And he's trying to say that, you know, thinking about whether there's a God is not like thinking about whether there is a teapot orbiting the planet Jupiter. It's much more profound than that. It's what lies at the basis of all things, at the basis of our lives, and I think is very important. Now, I mentioned earlier this massive change in cosmology. Let's just look at that a little bit more and reflect on where it takes us. This is from a writer you'll never have heard of, and I have to confess, I'm not even sure how to pronounce this. So if any of you are Swedish, you'll have to forgive me if I get this wrong. This is Dr. Arrhenius, and in his 1906 book, Worlds in the Making, he basically set out the consensus in the year 1906. The universe, in its essence, has always been what it is now. Matter, energy, life have only varied as to the shape and position in space. And Arrhenius won a Nobel Prize, and clearly he knew what he was talking about. And that was the consensus of the time. But again, my point to you is that science is so good because it's not locked into some kind of dogma. It, in effect, is open-ended and never-ending. In a sense, it keeps reviewing questions as evidence builds up. And I think many of you will know things changed during the 20th century. You can think of Edwin Hubble, you can think of a whole range of evidence that basically spoke about an expanding universe, and perhaps more importantly, a universe that had a beginning. And for most of us, this is so counterintuitive, we can't really take it in. If you were to say, my criterion of truth is whether I can get my head around it, then, you know, think of this question. If the universe is expanding, what does it expand into? Now, if you're a dyed-in-the-wool rationalist, say, look, that just makes no sense, it's wrong. But, you know, we don't say that because we realize that actually human reason is rather limited in these matters. And basically, the standard cosmological model basically is saying, look, there was this moment of origination. We can call it the Big Bang. And certainly there were those who didn't like this idea of the Big Bang at all because it sounded a little bit religious. For example, Fred Hoyle, a well-known atheist cosmologist, you know, just thought this was too religious. Or Steven Weinberg, a name I think many of you will know, writing back in 1967, saying in effect that Hoyle's idea of a steady state universe was, you know, much preferable. It's the most attractive theory because it least resembles the account given in the book of Genesis. Although he then added, it's a pity the steady-state theory is contradicted by experiment. But I think you can see where we're going here. Dawkins, for example, gives us the idea that there is a steady erosion of the plausibility of belief in God as science develops. But actually, I need to say to you that this isn't really the case. You know, the big debate now is, how do we relate the Big Bang, the idea of cosmic origination, to a narrative of creation, to the idea that in some way God created all things? These are not the same thing, I want to emphasize that, but you can see they kind of interact and lead us off in some very interesting directions. Some of you will know of this very famous 1948 debate about God between Bertrand Russell and Frederick Copleson. It was a big debate, covered a wide range of issues. It was on BBC Radio 3. It got a rather large audience for Radio 3, I have to say. On some aspects, Copleson got the upper hand. Can we have a sustainable morality without belief in God? Well, Copleson actually won that part of the debate. But Russell won the section of the debate. Do we need God to explain the universe? And Russell's answer was no. The universe has always been here. There is no need for an explanation. That's the end of the discussion. And actually, in 1948, that would have been a dominant position. And many of you will know that 50 years later, this debate was replayed. On the one hand, there was William Lane Craig. On the other, there was Anthony Flew, who at that stage was an atheist. And William Lane Craig, in effect, pressed Anthony Flew on precisely this point. If the universe had a beginning, then how did that happen? Either it came into being through a process we do not understand, or we can think of it as having in some way been originated, which of course plays straight into a Christian way of thinking about God. And Flew found himself very, very troubled and disconcerted by this, which in the end made him leave his atheism behind. I think he ended up being what I would loosely call a deist, certainly not a Christian, but certainly moving away from atheism. But there is another point here that I think we do need to make. It's all about this very interesting idea of levels of explanation. I want to focus on this point precisely because I think it's so interesting and so important. Dawkins, in effect, says, look, there are scientific explanations, there are other kinds of explanation, like religious explanation or something like that. And in the end, the scientific explanation is always going to win out. There can only be one valid explanation, and that means it's either this or it's the other. It cannot be both, and therefore a scientific explanation in the end is going to win. Now, I certainly would have thought that way in the past, but I think nowadays I'd say something like this. What if science, if we think of life as a big picture, what if science fills in part of that picture, but not the full picture? And the question really I want to explore with you is whether science needs supplementation, whether in effect it fills in part of the picture and other things come in to fill other parts of it. So let me give you this analogy, which many of you will know. It's very familiar, it's very simple, but it makes a very important point. This is the distinguished geologist Frank Rhodes, who went on to become president of Cornell University in the States during the 1990s. And he says, look, a kettle is boiling. I put the kettle on to boil. Why is the kettle boiling? He says, one obvious explanation is because of energy conversion. That in effect, if it's a gas ring, you know, then the gas is burning, it's converted to heat, which gradually brings the water to the boiling point. So there's a perfectly simple scientific explanation of why the kettle is boiling. He then says, of course, there's another reason, which is I wanted to make a cup of tea. Now just hold that in your mind. The scientific explanation is energy conversion. The other explanation is wanting a cup of tea. Does explanation one invalidate explanation two? No. Does explanation two invalidate explanation one? No. The two of them are part of a bigger picture. And the point that Rhodes is making is that we need that bigger picture if we're going to make sense of our universe and, more importantly, sense of our lives. So here's what he says, talking about those two answers I just mentioned. These are different answers, but both are true, both are complementary, and not competitive. One answer is appropriate within a particular frame of reference, the other within another frame of reference. There's a sense in which each is incomplete without the other. You can see how important that is, and it's easily extended. You might have a scientific account of the origin of the universe. It fills in part of the picture. What if a Christian account of creation by God fills in a different part of that picture? But actually, the two of them come together to give you a deeper and richer understanding of the way things are. So that seems to me to be an interesting point. The complexity of the universe demands a corresponding richness in our levels of explanation. And that, I think, opens the way to some very interesting ways of thinking. There's a philosopher, Mary Midgley. Many of you have read her. She's in her 90s. She writes very, very well. And she writes this. For most important questions in human life, a number of different conceptual toolboxes always have to be used together. And her point is that science is great, but nevertheless, it has its own domain of, domain of authority. But it's precise, and yet for that reason, it is not able to answer every question we have. And that, I think, is a very important point, because it, in effect, is asking this question, whether there are questions that lie beyond the scope of science, which we want answers to, forcing us to ask this question. Do we simply say, well, because science can't answer these, we say these questions are either unanswerable, or any answers that are given are simply spurious and illusory? Or do we say, well, we respect science for what it can do, and we're very careful not to make science into something else by forcing it to answer questions it can't answer. But we then bring other dialogue partners into the discussion. And in many ways, what Mary Midgley is arguing is for the need for what she says are many maps to try and help us grasp a very complex reality. That brings us to a very important point. And this is the whole question of meaning. And in many ways, I've been leading up to this gradually as we go our way through this essay. It is very easy to adopt reductionist approaches to humanity or to life. And we could say, as some do, look, we're just atoms and molecules. And certainly, you'll have heard that being said. I want to say to you, well, you know, it's absolutely right that we are atoms and molecules. So is this plastic cup of water I'm holding. It is also atoms and molecules. But I think I might want to say to you that each of you here tonight, although you too are made of atoms and molecules, there is rather more to you than this. You know, there's an issue here about saying, look, this is part of the picture, but the picture is much bigger than this. But those who say we're just atoms and molecules are saying that is the big picture. And I want to suggest that's not good enough. We need a richer understanding of who we are, which says, yes, we are atoms and molecules, but there is so much more that needs to be said. Or you might think of Richard Dawkins' idea, which you find in The Selfish Genes. He talks about our sole purpose being to reproduce our genes. He talks about dancing to the music of DNA. And I think that, you know, this is right. You know, there is a sense in which we are there to reproduce our genes. My question to you would be, is that it, or is that just part of the picture? And I could go on like this, talking about human nature. For example, we could say we are energy conversion machines. We process carbohydrates and stuff and derive energy from them. And that's part of the picture. But there is more to life than that. And in many ways, what I'm saying to you is we need a rich palette of colors if we're going to do justice to who we are and why we matter. And science is in there. It's part of that. And that's wonderful. But we do need more than that. We can't just reduce human significance to the level of our components. There are deep existential issues here. This is Peter Medawar, who won the Nobel Prize for Medicine back in the 1960s. He was a rationalist. He would probably self-define as an atheist, but he didn't really regard these questions as being of great importance. But he did think it was extremely important to calibrate science. He was very critical of those who deify science and very critical of those who defy science. And he said, they're both wrong. The right answer lies in the middle, welcoming science, but recognizing its limits. And there's a quote from a book he wrote towards the end of his life, which I think is really interesting. Only humans find their way by a light that illuminates more than the patch of ground they stand on. What he's saying is, look, we need this bigger picture. It's not enough just to ask, how do we survive? It's how do we lead good and meaningful lives? Now, those of you who are psychologists who study this will know there's a massive literature on why human beings need big pictures, on why we find the idea of meaning so important. That doesn't make it right, but it does make it very human. And one of the issues is, how do we make sure that as human beings we have this deeper vision of reality, which actually helps us to live life with a sense of meaning and purpose and so on. And Medawar is saying we need this. He wasn't himself religious. He was just saying, look, there is more to life than what science can give us. And again, think of that polarity. Deifying science. Science is it. That's the end of the matter. Defying it. Science is useless. Don't talk to it. Somewhere, there's a middle way which welcomes science as an enormously important conversation partner, but realizes there is more that needs to be said. For me, it's extremely important that scientists are human beings, precisely because that means that scientists, like me, would want to ask deeper questions than just, how does this work? Richard Dawkins does not think the universe has any meaning. And many of you will know this quote. It's from his book, A River Out of Eden, where he basically says, in effect, the universe isn't going anywhere. The universe we observe, he writes, has precisely the properties we'd expect. If there is a bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. And certainly when I was a young man, I would have agreed that. I put a great big tick against that and said, that's right. And okay, it's very, very bleak. And when I was, you know, in my teens, I would have said, the fact it's so bleak, so unattractive, is an indication of its rightness. You know, who's going to believe this stuff if it's not right because it's so unattractive? And it is a very bold vision. But there is obviously a query I'd want to, in effect, raise with you. What happens if Dawkins is looking at the universe through a lens that is out of focus? What happens if there are multiple lenses for looking at our universe and there are others that bring this into sharper focus? And C.S. Lewis, I think, is interesting here. I mean, some of you will have read his Chronicles of Narnia, and you may have read The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. And one of the characters asks one of the children, you know, to tell them about what a star is. In our world, said Eustace, a star is a huge ball of flaming gas. But the old man didn't really think that was a very good answer. Even in your world, my son, that's not what a star is, but only what it's made of. I think that is actually, though it's a children's book, there is a word of wisdom there, that identifying components is not the same as identifying meaning. Showing how something works, clarifying something's mechanism, is not the same as understanding its meaning. And I think is very important. In modern cultural anthropologies, I think many of you will know, there's this recognition of the importance of stories. You know, these are what give us meaning. We are animals, as Christian Smith, a well-known American sociologist, who must fundamentally understand what reality is, who we are, how we ought to live, by locating ourselves within larger narratives and meta-narratives that we hear and tell, and that constitute what is for us real and significant. That's really quite important. It has lots of implications. One of them, of course, is religious. The Christian story gives you a way of understanding the world, coping with suffering, living, hoping, and so on. And Lewis, I think, recognizes the importance of stories. Dawkins tends to think more in terms of conceptual schemes. For Lewis, it's more that we need these stories to make sense of things. He develops these in many ways. And if you think about the Chronicles of Narnia, one of the big questions is this: which story can we trust? And our culture clearly offers us multiple stories. One of them would be, I think, that we are simply random outcomes of a random process, therefore actually none of us really matter all that much. Another way of looking at that would be to say, well, actually we are God's children, and therefore we are enormously important precisely because we are loved by God. But the importance of stories seems to me to be really important. Back to Peter Medawar. This is a point that I think is really important, and it's one I wrestle with all the time. And I think most of you here tonight will recognize this. Medawar's argument goes like this. We need to acknowledge that there are questions that science cannot answer, and that no conceivable advance of science would empower it to answer. And one of the questions is the meaning of life. Now, sure, there are some scientists who would say science can answer these questions, but I do have to say they're in the minority. Most scientists would say this is just a classic example of a question which science can help us inform, but can't actually answer for us. What I'm saying to you tonight, really, is this. In talking about the whole question of science, faith, and God, Lewis and Dawkins both raise some wonderful questions. Dawkins rightly is saying, why do we believe certain things and not other things? And that needs to be absolutely respected. But it does need to be set alongside something else, which is the recognition of our epistemic limits, our inability to be able by ourselves to answer certain questions with the certainty that I think Dawkins would like. I admire Dawkins' aspirations very, very much. But in reality, things aren't like that. And we're in the situation where we, in effect, have to make judgment of what is good, what is right, for example. Or actually, we can't prove what we believe, even though we do feel we have very good reasons for those. I want to suggest to you that is a very helpful context for thinking about these deeper questions. And in the end, the question of meaning is unresolvable of science, precisely because it is not empirical. It may be that as a research method, science isn't able to uncover meaning. But maybe that's because the research method is actually designed to look at and find other things. And the point I'm simply making is that we really need this kind of thing. This is Alex Rosenberg's Atheist Guide to Reality. Some of you here tonight will be atheists. Let me just say immediately, I don't think this is very intelligent, and I would not impute this to atheists here tonight. It's on the screen for discussion, okay? Here's what he says. Is there a God? No. What's the nature of reality? What physics says it is? What's the purpose of the universe? There's none. What's the meaning of life? Ditto. What's the difference between right and wrong, good and bad? There's no moral difference between them. I think he's wrong there. I think you probably think he's wrong there too. I think what he probably should have said is something like this. Science is unable to discern a moral difference between them. But there's a world of difference between that and saying there is no difference between them. For you and I, what's right, what's wrong really matters. And if science isn't able to answer that question, well, we're not going to say, well, in that case, we just do what we like. We're going to say, right, let's move on and find some other way of thinking that enables us to do this. I'm beginning to run out of time. And I'm going to end, if I may, with this quote from José Ortega, a Spanish philosopher who I like very, very much. And like me, he loves science. But he's also acutely aware that that love for science means being deadly honest about its strengths and its limits. See if you think he's right. Scientific truth is characterized by its precision and the certainty of its predictions. But science achieves these admirable qualities at the cost of remaining on the level of secondary concerns, leaving ultimate and decisive questions untouched. Look at this last sentence. Scientific truth is exact, but it is incomplete. My own view, which I'm not forcing on you, I'm just saying this is the way I've come to think after, you know, a long period of reflection about science, faith, lots of stuff like that, is that actually science is great. And it's great precisely when it recognizes its limits. And in many ways, what we need to do is not contradict science, but actually enrich it. Again, that analogy of the big picture. Science fills in part of the picture, and that's great. But there's so much more that needs to be there if you and I are to live meaningful lives. What I'm suggesting to you is you can find a way of interweaving these narratives, a way of developing an enriched understanding of things. And what I try to do in this book I mentioned very briefly at the beginning of this talk, Inventing the Universe, just say, look, here are the ways after 40 years I've figured out of trying to relate science and faith. They work for me, but if they work for you, that's great. But whether you think they're right or not, I'm hopeful they will get a very good discussion underway. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening tonight.
Well, once again, Alistair, thank you for a superb talk, and I'm sure there are going to be many questions. Let me explain how we're going to do questions. There are going to be four microphones, two quite near the front, one each side, and two quite near the back, one at each side. They'll be held by some of our student friends. If you want to ask a question, if you could come up and queue up behind one of the microphones, which I hope will be coming in a moment down here. If you're from the gallery, or if there is anybody in the overflow, then you come to the back, and we'll take questions alternately. Whilst the microphones are coming to the front, Alistair, can I start with a question, which is one that always puzzles me, and that'll give us time to get everybody in place. Occam's razor, it's vain to do with more what can be done with less. Do you think that religion is an extra dimension which you don't really need in terms of contravening Occam's razor?
Well, I think that's a great question to get us started with. When I was at school, one of the books we had to read when we were studying, I think it was physics, was Richard Feynman's Elements of Physical Theory, something like that. And Feynman, on one of these pages, had a list of things which were popular myths, which a lot of people said were right, but actually were wrong. One of them was that the simplest theory is always the right theory. I think that's the problem. I mean, it is right to say, look, let's aim for the simplest possible theory. But reality intrudes, and very often it's a more complicated theory which is right. So simplicity is one of a number of virtues you might appeal to. You might appeal to elegance, you might appeal to comprehensiveness, you might appeal to fruitfulness as a criterion for evaluating theories. But I'm afraid Occam's razor is very useful as a critical tool. The problem is that some people turn it into a view of reality, and I don't think it works all that way, well, in that sense.
Now, there's a dearth of questions. I can't believe that people haven't got questions, so do come up to the mic. There's what good I'm... And just come up behind the mic, and we'll start with one this side. We may not be switched on at the bottom. Can we have one of the technicians just to check why the mics aren't working?
That sounds helpful. It's a very tame question, really, to start off. But Apart from a few essays and a few snippets, do you not wish that Lewis had actually written far more about the relationship or his thoughts about Christianity and science?
Yes, thank you. Yes, I mean it's a good question. In preparing for this lecture, Lewis has a few essays on this, and there are hints in various writings about what he thinks about science, but he never wrote a book called Faith and Science. And I regret that, because I think he was very, very interesting. What he does write shows a surprisingly good knowledge of science, which means he obviously talked to scientists who were there at Magdalen College when he was a fellow. Interestingly, one of them was Peter Medawar. And one of the questions everyone wants to know is whether Lewis and Medawar, you know, had conversations together. I don't know. I think, nevertheless, Lewis, even if he doesn't answer his own questions, does raise some very good questions, and I've tried to kind of feed into our conversation some of the questions he would raise. Thank you.
That's right. We're going to alternate sides, then we'll go to the back.
Hi, good evening. Would you argue against, or could you speak to the fact that it seems to me that you say that you come from a point that science is finite, that it cannot answer certain questions. It seems that you believe that it is finite, that it is explained and done all it can do, and now we have to invoke the supernatural to fill the gaps. Is that not a logical fallacy, to God of the gaps fill unanswerable questions with a very quick good supposition that God exists?
Thank you. It's a very good question. It's a classic question, so I'm very pleased to begin to respond to it. I think there are some religious people who would say, well, you know, science can't explain this, so we put God in that gap. In other words, God is located in explanatory gaps. And most Christians who are scientists would say that's just nonsense for two reasons. Number one, those gaps are going to get smaller, so God will get squeezed out. But secondly, I mean, who wants a God like that? You know, it's a very simple question. C.A. Coulson, who was a professor of theoretical chemistry at Oxford back in the 70s, who I got to know quite well, was very, very critical of this. He said, look, what you need to be aware of is that the reason people believe in God is not because of these alleged explanatory gaps. It's because, as Albert Einstein says, explicability requires explanation. In other words, there's a meta question here. You know, why is it that we can make so much sense of things? We need a kind of framework that is able to say why science works so well, not as an accident, just a bit of good luck, but actually as something that's built into the order of things. And Coulson's answer, which I actually quite like, he's saying, look, if you take a Christian view of reality, what you have is, in effect, a big picture which talks about a regular universe created by God, a universe that's open to interpretation, and it's not explanatory gaps. It's the fact that that framework is there at all. And for Coulson, that was really the thing that attracted him. I have to say, actually, that when I think of my own transition from atheism to Christianity, it was that sense, you know, if this is right, it makes an awful lot of sense, which really moved me along. So I think I sense you're being critical of the idea of God of the gaps. I would certainly agree. I think it's unhelpful and doesn't take us in any good directions. Thank you.
And one at the back there.
Thank you. As an agnostic, still thinking about these things, You keep using the word God. I'd be very grateful if you could explain what those three letters mean, please.
Someone would like to know what God is. And I will fail to do justice to what is a wonderful question. But let me put it like this. For me, God was something I discovered. I didn't want there to be a God. I took the view that, I was perfectly capable of coping with life without this kind of thing. But for me, God is something, someone, that is so big that he gives me this picture of the world which enables me to make sense of why the world is here, who I am, why I matter, and reassures me that I'm special. There's a very interesting essay by Salman Rushdie, who's not a great exponent of religious belief, but knows why it matters. And he said, look, we all need something which, in effect, helps us to realize that we are so small by giving us something that's so big to compare it with. And he says that that's what God does, but more than that, reassures us that even though we are small, we are special. If you were asking me what God looks like, and I would have to justify this answer in quite an extended way, but for me, the best visual image of God we're ever going to have. It is Jesus Christ. That for me is a kind of lens which lets us see what God is like. But it would take me a long time to explain that properly, so it's a very brief answer to a very good question.
Question back
there? Thank you. It seems to me that part of the problem of relating science to religion is that science has moved its boundaries an awful lot over history. It began with inductive method and law-like behavior and microscopes. And now, in terms of evolution, has moved to the area of archaeology, in terms of multiverse, almost like Platonic abstracts, which can never be seen, or it's difficult to find out whether they're actually proven or not. So religion is trying to relate to all those different kinds of, I would say there were different kinds of truth. I wouldn't say there were one body of knowledge, even. And that's part of the issue. Do you agree with that?
I think I agree with you up to a point. I think you've made the point that science is vast. I mean, there's so many scientific disciplines. There are probably lots of them represented here tonight. I only know two of them. I know the physical sciences, I know biology, but there's oodles more than that. And of course, they all have their distinct methods. And what you very often find is that scientists working in one discipline actually don't know very much about the others. So it's a real problem. And therefore, I tend to end up talking about science and faith, meaning this particular area of science I know and faith, which of course, as you rightly say, is quite limiting. Although I think there are some general principles you can draw out like this. But I think you're right to emphasize that in effect, science is very, very diverse, very, very big. But I think one of the key things that lies behind it is this deep sense that we can make sense of this world. In other words, whether we're looking at the physical world or the way society functions, or indeed the way individual human beings function, that actually there's some deeper pattern that's there to be discovered. And for me, I think that's a real driving force for science. Actually, I mean, that's the thing that drove me to discover religion as well, the sense that if there is a God, and obviously, that's up for discussion, but if there is a God, it does give you this deeper pattern, this richer framework for making sense of things. Now, of course, for me, as you can probably tell, I'm quite a rational person. I don't think of my faith in terms of ideas and so on. And there are many people here tonight who will say, well, for us, faith is more about experience. It's about love and things like that. And they're right, but I'm just saying that from my perspective, one of the great things about faith is the way in which it helps you make sense of such a complex world. And actually, the motivation that led me to discover faith is actually very similar to the motivation that made me discover science in the first place. A sense there is this wonderful, complicated world, I want to understand it better. And actually, that's a double motivation for science, but also for faith. Thank you.
That's fine.
Lewis, in his book Miracles, seems to propose that our ability to reason or to have confidence in our reason necessarily commits us to the view that atheism, or at least materialism, is false, or at the very least implausible. What do you think of this idea? Can you expound on it and say whether you think it's good or bad?
Thank you. Let me just amplify a little bit, set context, and then reply. In his book Miracles, particularly the third edition, Lewis had to revise it because Elizabeth Anscombe helped him to sort out one or two bits of it. But Lewis's argument goes like this. If human reason is simply the random or meaningless outcome of cosmic accidents, then we have to recognize we are using this as a tool to investigate the universe. And for Lewis, there was a sort of internal contradiction there. And Lewis doesn't use this to disprove atheism. He's more using it to say there is this influential school of thought which is saying, look, this is just a random universe. It's going nowhere. It doesn't mean anything. And that our minds are, in effect, just outcomes of this random process. But Lewis is saying that actually the danger is that this way of thinking about things undermines the plausibility of reason as a critical tool. You're using reason to discover irrationality. So Lewis, I don't think it's disproving atheism. He didn't see himself as doing that. He was simply saying there are certain inconsistencies in a purely naturalist account of reality. But again, I need to talk a lot longer on that because it's more complicated than that. Thank you.
Hi, Hi. I wondered what your thoughts were on what Alfred Ayer said in his book Language, Truth and Logic when he talked about how ultimately this discussion is, I think he said, nonsensical because we're using empirical language and empirical methods like the scientific method to talk about something which is essentially metaphysical, like the transcendent God of Christianity.
Yes, I mean, the question here is about A.J. Ayer's very famous book, Language, Truth and Logic, which really springs out of the Vienna school, although I'd have to say the Vienna school didn't quite like the way in which Ayer developed their ideas. But I think one of the key things that emerges from that is Ayer, in effect, is defending what you and I might call a radical empiricalism, that in effect we limit ourselves to what can be observed. For example, I observe that in the front row here there are three people. That's verifiable. We don't have to say, actually, at 8:54 on the 4th of November there were three people in the front row, because that's not going to be true at another time. And what Ayer was saying is that empirical statements like that are valid. Everything else is just kind of way wishful thinking, speculation, metaphysical statements which cannot be verified like that and therefore have no meaning. I think that there are two things to say. One is that actually it's not really a very good account of science. Because if you think about it, I mean, one of the things that science does is to say, look, on the basis of what we observe, for example, think of Newton observing planetary motion and apples falling to the ground. You say, look, we could explain this if we hypothesize there's a thing called gravity, which we can't see with our senses, but if it were there, it makes an awful lot of sense of things. And people like Victor Lenz would say that the problem with Ayer's method is that actually unobservable entities are excluded from his account of science. And of course, for us, that theoretical entities are very, very important. But much more interesting is what Ayer said late in life. And you may have seen the very famous interview with Brian McGee, where in effect Ayer said, well, look, I only had one really good idea, the one you just mentioned. And unfortunately, it was wrong. and I think I admire him enormously for saying that. But I think he's right, because it's just so simplistic that actually you have this idea that, if I can parody him a little bit, metaphysical statements make no sense. But this is a metaphysical statement. So, you know, you can see where it's going like that. And so I think basically what I'd say is I value Ayer's insistence on engaging with reality. But I think he was a little bit restrictive in terms of what we could actually get out of that. And in the end, we need to develop all these heuristic tools to be able to engage reality. And to use John Polkinghorne's phrase, this involves a bit of intellectual precariousness. But nevertheless, it's justified, because it occasionally leads us on to some much better outcomes than would otherwise be the case. Thank you.
Good evening. My question is, why Christianity? Why not some other monotheistic religion? So belief in God is not at all limited to Christianity, and many of the ideas expressed in your slides that were non-atheist need not be either. So what is it that Christianity has in preference over other religions, some much more ancient than Christianity is?
Well, I think most religions would track their origins back. I mean, Christianity has always seen itself as emerging out of Judaism in kind of way, preserving what it regards being best in that tradition. It's the same God, so to speak. And I think that's an important point to bear in mind. As you rightly point out, I mean, the word religion is actually not a good word. I mean, it's a word we've invented, but it actually is one of these words that we use without necessarily being able to clarify what it means. And so, as you rightly say, a lot of religions are not theistic at all. And I think I'd also make the point that actually, I mean, a philosophy of life which acknowledges the transcendent, for example, Iris Murdoch, actually, although she doesn't believe in God, she believes in something which actually does the job of God, at least in some respects. So you're quite right to make that very general point. For me, Christianity gives me the best conceptual toolkit I could possibly imagine to deal with things. And it's partly because the Christian vision of God is just so rich, this idea of a Trinitarian God. But above all, it gives you this intellectual framework for looking at the world, which is able to not just make sense of the world, but actually engages head on the problem of suffering. Now, I haven't really talked about it at all tonight, and that needs separate lecture. But for Christianity, the fact that Christ suffered is just so important. It, in effect, begins to give you an anchor between God and suffering. It means that when we experience suffering, we are not in an incoherent world, but there's rather some link with a caring God who journeys with us as we suffer. Now, anyway, clear, I'm not disrespecting any religion at all. I'm just saying that the reason why I'm drawn to Christianity is that I feel very strongly it has certain things going for it, and that for me is very, very important. But you're right to suggest at least some of the things I've said this evening could be found in other religious traditions. If that's so, I'm very pleased. But from my own perspective, it's just that Christianity gives me a sort of a particularly coherent and exciting way of looking at things, which continues to excite me even after 40 years of discovering it. Thank you.
Hi, I'm quite young, so I don't know if I feel my place here properly, but I want to think, why does it matter? We all live quite happily in this room together, we're all quite happy people. Why does it matter if some people believe in God and some don't? Why does it matter that 700 years ago some people thought the world was flat, yet suddenly it's round? And why does it matter? I just don't see what the point of this whole argument is. If we're all happy together as people, why does it matter if there's this whole super being that will look after us and give some people cancer and some not? You know, why is it a problem that I should have to worry about as a human that lives in the world that is so simplistic and mathematical?
Well, you don't have to worry about it at all. I'm just saying, if there are people here tonight who think these questions matter and important, then I'm offering some ideas that may be helpful. But I think I would say that you say a lot of things don't matter. If I were to press you harder, there might be some things that do matter. Is rape right? Rape.
No, but I don't need a book to tell me that it is.
No, but you see, I can tell. Listen to me. I can tell from your tone that you think this matters.
Well, yeah, because it's the unjust act. I don't think that I need a book to tell me that I should or shouldn't do something. It's in my brain. I was not Christian when I was brought up. I've never been exposed to the Word of God. I know that I shouldn't do something else that somebody wants to do to me.
Well, then we're agreed that certain things matter.
That doesn't mean that I believe in God, or I think that you should believe in God. Just because I agree with something you do doesn't mean we both agree on the same point.
No, the issue is...
I should do an unjust act to another.
No, the issue is simply, are there things that matter? And if so, how can we help each other grasp things more accurately? Which means dialogue, discussion...
By not sitting around and thinking about it. Why should I sit around and think, oh, God's an all-powerful being, therefore he must have a plan? Well, I should sit there and investigate.
I mean, this is Bristol University. I hope you do sit around and think quite a lot. there's more that needs to be said. Thank you. Okay. One more, I think.
Yeah, okay. We're getting near the end, so you're lucky you're the last one. Sorry about it, everybody, but we've...
Thank you very much for a really stimulating discussion tonight. I'd just like to say, I've just finished reading Godless for God's Sake, Non-Theism as a Perspective on Quakerism. And my journey has sort of been reflected by that, I guess, really. And what I was seized by in your talk this evening was the concept that reality is God, and science is a lens that focuses on reality and tries to dissect reality. And maybe religion is another lens with which we can look at reality and thus see the true face of it, i.e. God. But I've always seen, you know, that deification of science. I'm a scientist. I work on proto-life in the chemistry department here. And so I see God as emergent from science itself. And I was just wondering what your thoughts were on that in terms of how you weight faith in God over faith in science, because as you said, we can only falsify a theory, we can never really prove it. And so really, I guess what it comes down to is, how do you weight your faith?
I get the point. That's a good one. On your second point, I mean, you're right. You know, it's very, very hard to verify. It's easier to falsify. But actually, sometimes a theory is falsified, and then it's shown that actually the criteria of falsification were wrong. I was thinking of Dalton's atomic theory being a very good example. But anyway, I think that to give a short answer to what was a very good question, I like stereoscopic vision. It means I see things more clearly, I see depth. And in many ways, what I'm saying is that while there's a lot more needs to be said to develop this point, having an eye of faith, an eye of science, actually enriches what others see. It gives depth to science. And I suppose if I could put it like this, I mean, This is what John Paul II, the Pope, once said, and actually I think he puts this quite well. He says, look, science demands of religion, show us that you are talking sense. Right. Religion says to science, look, we need questions of value and meaning, and so, you know, there's a lot more to life than technology. And I think actually, I mean, I'm sure there's more that needs to be said, but that's the beginning of a very interesting conversation. And I think in many ways, the basic plea of my talk tonight is not so much, you know, science or religion, I think they're both wonderful. It's actually, if they could talk to each other a bit more, that might actually help both. But that would take another lecture. But thank you for asking that.
Well, Alistair, thank you very much. I know that we could go on asking questions for a long time, but Alistair's got to get back to Oxford. He'll be tired enough if he goes now. If he waited any longer, he'd fall asleep at the wheel. So thank you very much indeed for coming. Let's show our appreciation.